Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning to you.
How are you, sir?
Baruch Hashem.
Well, former judge, South African Richard Goldstone, has a retraction in his op-ed, which was in the Washington Post, not in the New York Times, which we'll talk about in a minute. He writes, "We know a lot more today about what happened in the Gaza War of 2008-2009 than we did when I chaired the fact-finding mission appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council that produced what has come to be known as the Goldstone Report. If I had known then what I know now, the Goldstone Report would have been a different document." Malcolm, what did he know? What does he know now that he didn't know then?
Well, what he should have known then and what he could have known then, but wasn't really interested in, and assumed the responsibility with a mandate that was one-sided, biased, acknowledging that the source of the mandate, the Human Rights Council, that Israel can't get a fair hearing there. And even in this almost mea culpa and almost apology, which he has already qualified since writing the article and saying that he doesn't retract the report, and I would anticipate that we'll see more backtracking. And I think it was a mistake for Eli Yishai to call him right away and invite him to Israel and to, you know, already assume conclusions, which I think have yet to be proven.
Right.
It is helpful that he wrote this. It is not conclusionary. It does not end the attempts to use the report to go to the International Court of Palestinians and make clear that they will do so. In addition, he said, for instance, that that in the discussion of this, that no one disputed the report's factual allegations, which is simply not true. And he didn't say it again when he wrote the op-ed piece. But there are none of the report's demands on Israel, I think there were 9 or 10 of them, call for the investigation. In fact, the investigation started before his empowerment of the Goldstone Commission and the report that they wrote. So there are a lot of assertions there, and I could, you know, you could dissect it point by point to analyze the whole thing. He does acknowledge that the Palestinians have never and never will put a price on for Palestinians for the crimes against humanity or victimizing Jews. The Hamas has done no investigation, and the failure, though, to acknowledge the extent to which Israel goes to avoid civilian casualties, when he now knows from the reports how far Israel went, not only in investigating itself, and he said that the investigations are credible, and I don't want to downplay that this it's significant. The problem is that the damage is done. You can't undo the damage to Israel and to the IDF and to Israel's image and the exploitation by Israel's enemies of this. It is like the murderer who kills his parents and then pleads for mercy as
right.
an orphan. We have to understand the extent to which the Goldstone Report did damage.
I
think he recognized the price that his grandchildren and great-grandchildren carrying his name pay for his misdeeds.
Well, was that it? I mean, I'd love to analyze the political aspect of this. I mean, the pressure on both sides. I'm sure that there was some pressure that led him to retract. There's probably other pressures, as you just indicated, that's going to lead him to retract some of the retraction or, you know, do more of that over the next few weeks. What were the two pressures? What was going on both sides that he felt the need to go public with all this?
Well, you know, he had been very defiant after publishing the report and stood by it and did not indicate it at all the true nature of the report. And he still doesn't fully acknowledge the lies and distortions that comprise
right.
the Goldstone Report. And I think and I think he doesn't disavow a lot of the aspects, nor is he willing to go to bat now and go to the Secretary General and say, I want this withdrawn. You can't really withdraw it. What you can do is have some sort of a contrary statement or have the Human Rights Council, which mandated it, issue some sort of a retraction. But it's like Zionism was racism. You can't
right.
undo a resolution like that.
Yeah,
you have to pass another resolution that counters it.
Right, but
I think it reminds us of why there's no tshuva, there's no repentance for talking Lashon Hara against Israel, for slandering Israel, because the damage can't be undone.
Such an important point you're making, such an important point. But was it mostly this personal thing? In other words, there's nobody in the UN, there's nobody in the Israeli government. Of course, you know, the critics out there will say that there are people in the Israeli government putting pressure on him, influencing him, spending the last couple of years, you know, trying to convince him that the report should have said other things than it actually did. I mean, was it really, in your opinion, this retraction just a personal matter, no political pressure from anybody to get out there and make a pro-Israel statement?
Well, there's been a barrage of criticism and controversies, but I know a little bit about the background, so I don't want to go into too much, but I would say that it was the personal interventions of people not political who, I think, helped bring him around to this conclusion. I think it was some of the experience, and maybe, we hope, that his conscience awoke and said, what did you do?
So there could be people who have been working on this since the report came out.
Yes, you could say that.
I could say that. And I would assume none of them are in the Israeli cabinet.
No. This has nothing to do with the Israeli government. It's not Zionist pressure. It's
not
him all of a sudden rediscovering his Zionism.
Right.
I think he saw the reports. He said, he slandered Israel.
Right. The New York Times supposedly turned down a request to put this retraction in the paper.
Well, I think it's more complicated. According to some of the reports that have appeared, he had written an initial version that was a much more watered-down one, and that is what they rejected.
Watered-down meaning it didn't seem definitive enough to the editorial board of the New York Times?
To anybody, that it wasn't really a retraction, or even it didn't go as far as he went in this, which is not a full retraction.
Right.
Welcome as it is, but it's really not. And the other version, I understand, was sent to not just the New York Times and rejected because it was just not meaningful.
Now, there's a meeting today between the Secretary General of the United Nations and the President of Israel. I mean, the timing is interesting with this whole thing. Is there UN pressure? You mentioned that, Goldstone now, again, is starting to retract the retraction a little bit. Is that because of UN pressure? Others, who's responsible for that?
Probably him again. I don't know. I mean, he obviously got a barrage of criticism, and others who were involved in the Goldstone report, he just was the chairman, have announced that they're standing by their conclusions and their report. So I think he will continue to refine his point of view. The subject will come up in the meeting. I met with President Peres last night, yesterday, and in Washington earlier in the week. He will press for them to take action, or to at least acknowledge that falsity of the Goldstone report. The Prime Minister has called for it to be rescinded. I'm not sure of the legal mechanism to do that. The problem is that they have said they're going to still use it.
Hold that point, because there's something going on with our phone line. I'm going to try to reconnect with Malcolm in a second. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. And we'll try to continue our weekly update in just a moment. And see if this sounds any better for everybody. Malcolm, are you there?
Yep.
I don't know what's going on. I have a feeling it's on our end, and I apologize, but we will try to continue. I wanted to make sure everyone could hear the point you're making. You were saying that, again, acknowledging that there will be a meeting at the UN today, and to tell me how the Goldstone topic will be included?
The Goldstone topic will be raised by Paris. He will ask for a rescission.
Malcolm, give me one more chance. I apologize. Give me one more chance to reconnect. Let's try this one. We'll take this quick break, unusual for the weekly update. Back with Malcolm Honlein and JM in the AM. All right, let's try this now. Malcolm, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Much better. Go ahead. Address the UN meeting and how Goldstone will be included. Go ahead.
I think they're sabotaging the line.
It could be. This is much better. Go ahead.
Okay. So what I was saying is that I met Peres earlier in the weekend last night. He is going to raise it. He is going to ask them to rescind it. I don't know that there's a legal mechanism to rescind it, as the Prime Minister has asked, but it certainly could have a lot of weight if the Secretary General were to say that, or apologize, or semi-apologize, or acknowledge Goldstone's apology or retraction, and to say that you know, they will not allow further action, or that the call on the Human Rights Council to stop. As you know, there's very little that stops anything in the Human Rights Council, which has been chaired by Iran, Libya, Syria, and all the great human rights advocates of our day. So the Prime Minister will raise it. He will also, I think, be pressing the issue of the unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state. I think he will obviously be talking about the regional developments, as he did with the president earlier in the week.
Will Peres, I would hope, he'll be equipped to react to Ban Ki-moon's pressure when it comes to the PA state declaration of the UN to say that with all the unrest in the Middle East right now, this is probably not the best time to go ahead and make that type of decision?
Well, I heard him on this subject, and I must say he makes an extremely credible case. And, you know, he has a lot of credibility in sectors where others don't, that his coming out and talking about how this will destabilize the region, destabilize the chance for peace, how it will embolden others. It's obviously a top priority for us. We have a meeting Monday of all the organizations to plan our attacks on this. We've been working on it for several months, hoping that it would be derailed. The United States is clearly opposed to it. I know he discussed it with the president. I met with the administration officials both Monday and Tuesday about it. They are clearly opposed to it. And the question is how far they will go. The problem is that it will likely not come down to a U.S. veto, because they will go to the General Assembly, not just the Security Council. And there are even ways to go to the Security Council without coming to a vote. But this is a very dangerous move. It has broad implications. It is the way to avoid negotiations. It's part of the delegitimization of Israel. The fact that Europeans and others are flirting with it, the fact that so many South American countries have already supported it and announced that they're going to open embassies and recognize the Palestinian state, is emboldening Abbas, who is going today to Cairo, and I believe may well meet with Hamas there, because I know the Hamas leaders have been invited. This is the first visit since the change in Egypt, and as you know, his relationship with Mubarak wasn't great.
Right.
So this could be a very critical in the progress between his efforts to get Hamas to join in some sort of unity government. I don't think that we're there now. I don't think that's going to happen now, but it's certainly an important step if they have that meeting.
We got to talk about the attack in the south and what's happening in Gaza, and we will in just a couple of minutes. But on the UN issue, first of all, Susan Rice, American ambassador to the UN, has been, at least the quotes I saw, it looks like she's amazing when it comes to her opinion on Goldstone's retraction.
Well, she was very strong in it, and if you remember, I mean, the United States did express its reservations at the time. There were several other voices, but very muted. If you look at the European reaction, if you look at the other reaction, generally pretty muted to this kind of blockbuster. If it had gone the other way,
this didn't get the publicity that the original report got. That's for sure.
That's putting it mildly.
I mean, crazy, I'll tell you. Two other things. First of all, at home, and I'm seeing some interesting polls, and I know poll numbers, you know, you're always skeptical, rightfully so, but I've seen some interesting polls out of Israel in terms of what Israelis want Netanyahu to do right now. If he would proceed and try to make overtures to the PA, would it be detrimental to him at home? Are the polls so one-sided now in terms of folks who want him to stay away from the negotiating table that would really hurt him domestically?
Well, I think it's safe to say that Israelis are much more pessimistic and have become so over the recent years that peace with the Palestinians will ever be achieved, and about the direction of the relationship, and less supportive of these initiatives. But if it's a meaningful one, if it's one where he can rationalize it to the Israeli people, and security is obviously the first consideration, then I think that there would not be that kind of opposition. I think people are prepared to explore it. I think when it comes to actually making a deal, they're going to want many assurances, and especially when you see a poll that shows a third of the Palestinians supported the killing of the Fogel family.
Right.
I mean, it's one thing to talk about military confrontation when they can endorse such a brutal murder. it is really a very disturbing result, which actually has had a significant impact in Israel.
Yeah, and that gives us an opportunity to remember who the enemy is. The other question I mean, I know this sounds silly, but is there any member of the IDF who was in cast lead who is somewhat happier today because of this retraction by Goldstone, or when it comes to the, you know, the average Israeli soldier, if there is such a thing, or the average Israeli hero, it's basically insignificant?
No, it is significant to them because they take so seriously. And I have met soldiers who told me how they put their lives at risk because they would not shoot at civilian populations. And people don't know how many Israeli soldiers died because rather than kill civilians, and especially children, they put themselves in a situation where they themselves were put in danger, and often that danger carried out.
Right.
So I think for many of them, it is a bit of a relief. Whether it will stop the lawsuits and the war crimes charges,
and the boycotts and the divestments,
and all of the charges which they said, because Israel kills civilians. I mean, you look at what's happening in Libya. I mean, where does that even come? Israel come close to operating in a theater like that without restriction? Israel could easily have carpeted bombed Gaza or Lebanon, mm-hmm. and put an end to the war very quickly. But they didn't, because they didn't want to cause that kind of damage and those kind of casualties. And many people debated afterwards what the wisdom is and what the right approach is. I think Israel's humanity and values are very important. And the fact is that they sustain it, even if the world doesn't acknowledge it. And ultimately, the truth out. The question is how much damage is done before it does.
Yeah, and that we've seen. By the way, Rice, when she addressed the Goldstone Report, also, at least according to Jerusalem Post, indicated that the U.S. is nearly certain to boycott Durban 3?
Well, if Durban 3 goes ahead as it was initially planned or discussed, I think that the United States is likely to boycott. They have not made a decision yet to boycott.
So nothing's official.
Indicated that if it's not acceptable, they will boycott. Canada and Israel are the only ones who have announced it.
Right.
And it might be premature now to get the full announcement. What we do want is the markers to be put down. And the efforts in the United Nations right now are to play it down. Even Ban Ki-moon, all of them, do not want it to become the circus that it was in the past. I think they will. And remember, it's the day when all the key leaders are here,
right,
from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
This is the last thing they need, is a diversion in another racist and bigoted gathering. So my anticipation is that they will try to limit it without NGOs to some sort of a restatement of the fight against racism and try to keep it. And Ban Ki-moon told us that he would try to keep it from becoming state-specific with charges against Israel.
So that might also be on the agenda today with the president of Israel.
It's 100% on the agenda.
And in addition to that, is this any different than a couple of months ago? Because a couple of months ago, you also felt the U.S. was heading in the boycott direction. So today, her statement makes you feel that even more so? It's basically the same?
No, it is the same. It is consistent,
right, with
the direction that's been taken. We wanted a statement that the United States will not participate if, in fact, it goes in this direction. And I think she did that well. But right now, a lot of this is being eclipsed by the concern over the unilateral declaration in September by the Palestinians of a state. And that has taken on much greater urgency and significance over recent months, and we have discussed it many times. Unfortunately, both here and in Israel, I think they did not take it seriously early enough.
All right, this 16-year-old boy continues to be in critical condition. The school bus attack from yesterday, this was a rocket that was launched from Gaza. The prime minister said this bombing crossed the line, and it looks like the reaction backs up those words, in that the Israeli Air Force pretty quickly went over Gaza and took action. Why did this one cross the line when Israel's been under a barrage, especially in the last few weeks down south?
Well, I do agree that it's crossed the line for a long time when you have mortars and rockets being fired indiscriminately at civilian populations. And yesterday they hit home, and as they did earlier, if you remember, in Beersheba, and one of them landed right next to a shul, and between a shul and homes. So I think the line was crossed a long time ago. What makes this particularly egregious, I think, is the fact that they could see that this was a yellow bus, which is internationally recognized,
right,
as being a school bus,
mm-hmm.
and that it had 50 children on board just minutes earlier, and they had been discharged at various stops, and the young 16-year-old was the only one remaining on the bus, and they used an anti-tank missile. There is no protection against it. I mean, if it hits a tank, it penetrates it. And they have hundreds of these, we believe, and the supplied by Iran probably, but they're Russian-made. These things are such a lethal weapon of destruction. This was deliberate because it has up to a 4-kilometer range, but it was fired by at a kilometer and a half, so they could see through binoculars what the target was. It was deliberate, and that's why I think it is seen as so particularly egregious.
What did the Israeli Air Force do?
It hit 9 targets in Gaza. We don't know the full extent of the damage. They're claiming that a number of people are killed, and of course they always will say civilians are killed because they're shooting from within civilian populations, mm-hmm. and if you want to hit the targets, the responsible party for any deaths is the Hamas and the others who have been firing these things. And it comes within a setting, if I can take just a second, because I know we don't have a lot of time, but, you know, a lot of things took place this week related and directly and indirectly. You had a guy taken out in the Sudan, a very important maneuver that took place there, and he was in charge of the arms procurement and other efforts of Hamas. A really bad guy, so to speak, and the fact that he was eliminated probably by a drone attack, which was really set them back, and it's the first attack in Sudan in a long time. I think there was one a few years ago, but here it was done by remote by a drone that then disappeared towards the back to the sea, and the guy who was taken out in a car with it, and they didn't allow anybody to go near it, which means there were probably a lot of explosives, and we know that there was several times convoys of trucks that were crossing the border into Egypt on their way to the Sudan. The Egyptians stopped one 2 weeks ago. But it also relates to the capture of the other terrorist from Hamas, who was caught probably in the Ukraine. That's Abu Sisi, which a name people will remember because he's going to go on trial. They have already leaked his indictment, which is a message to other leaders of Hamas that they're going to be next. And the taking out of Abdul Latif Ashkar in Sudan was probably based on information that Abu Sisi gave them. And the indictment indicates clearly that he has given them additional indictments. So there were also 2 Hamas gangs, one in East Jerusalem and one in Ramallah, that were broken up. Recently, the IDF took out in Khan Yunis 3 of the top operatives who came to Israel to try to kidnap Israelis. They were trying to do a pre-Pesach attack in which they would capture Israelis. They dug tunnels under the border from Gaza. Thank God so far it's been caught. Unfortunately, Egypt has stopped building that containment barrier that was supposed to be built to stop the smuggling into Gaza, and we believe that they have added to their arsenal of weapons, and we see an increasing ties opening between Hamas and the Egyptian political entities. So these are all interrelated. The capture of Sisi, the taking out in Sudan, and the attacks, as well as Israel's increased efforts to try and forestall or prevent any kind of terrorist attack within the borders.
So it's not. Yeah, I was just going to say it's not enough to protect Israel. Israel has to have connections, let's say, all around the world.
And we should know, when people hear about Abu Sisi, I mean, this is the guy who was the godfather of their rocket program. He's the one who expanded their range from 6 to more than 20 kilometers. He has played a key role in the deaths of many people by virtue of his involvement. So these are not, you know, just run-of-the-mill terrorists that somebody happened to decide to pick up. This is on the order of the elimination of some of the Hamas leaders in the past, which we know is an effective thing, and it sends a message. And that's why Hamas yesterday asked for a ceasefire or declared a ceasefire, because they're hitting close to home.
Is there, in fact, a ceasefire today?
As far as I know, today so far there has been a ceasefire. But that, you know, lasts until
longer
in their interest, and then they start again.
That I understand. Without the Israeli intervention, would there have been one? Or did they, I mean...
There was no reason to believe that there would have been any kind of a ceasefire, given the track record and the increasing numbers. You had 187 this year alone before this attack, so you're well over 200. They were for a whole day, the people in the south were living in, were in the bunkers. The school was is closed today again in the areas nearest to Gaza because of the threat of missile fire. This is not a way people can live, and Israel is not only in its rights, but it's essential that it takes these steps. And the United States has repeatedly said about spoken of Israel's right to defend itself. Even some of the Europeans today have called it a dastardly attack, the one on the school bus. But, you know, they don't follow it up. They don't talk about the next step. And the situation is compounded by virtue of the changes in Egypt. There was an interesting poll in Egypt this week that said that 60% support peace with Israel, which is contrary to what a lot of the leadership and certainly the Muslim Brotherhood and others have been arguing. What it also showed is that al-Baradei gets 2% approval, and Amri Musa, who's not a great friend, also got 37%. So there's nobody with a clear majority, but and the head of the military got in between about 15-16%, I think. So it's a very divided situation. It's politically, I think, unstable. You know, people look at the circumstances, but don't really necessarily understand. About 40% said they had a favorable opinion of the Muslim Brotherhood. 50% supported the secular party, but the, you know, this is a situation very much in flux, and that feeds the situation in Gaza.
What does it mean when they say that Iron Dome succeeded for the first time?
Because it was successful in stopping a missile, and Iron Dome, as you know, is very important. It's very important visibly. We have now the short range and we have long range. Now they got to work on the medium range. But it was successful in taking out a missile and sends a message. But the problem is that it's so costly to operate against, you know, missiles that cost relatively little to produce. You know, when they take when they shoot these Katyushas, they can cost them $100, and they spend $100,000 to fire Iron Dome and the missiles necessary to counter it.
Did you see the WikiLeaks leak that Hezbollah is prepared for a long conflict with Israel with a 20,000 rocket arsenal?
There are a series of WikiLeaks that will come out, or have come out. I didn't check today yet how much was published, but there are very interesting WikiLeaks focusing on the Middle East, where the leader of Bahrain talks of his ties to Israeli intelligence, where Lieberman talks about the political concessions and his favorite amongst the Palestinians. He talks about many other things and his discussions and talks about his entry into the Olmert government. Very interesting.
Also talks about Israeli intervention with the smuggling near Egypt.
Pardon me?
There's another one that talks about Israeli intervention with the smuggling near Egypt.
With the smuggling, and there are others that address both the internal political situation in Israel, quotes from all of the leaders in various relationships, because these are, remember, these are the messages that American ambassadors sent to Washington.
Right.
So you're picking up their accounts of their discussions. Some of them, I'm sure, are going to be very sensitive. But so far, these were not harmful. I think, actually, for Lieberman, it's probably going to help his image.
That's for sure. All right, Malcolm, excellent as usual. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak next week.
God willing. Thank you.
Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM.